There we go. Chabura number 7. We're still going through the handout of Chabura that began a couple of times ago. So this handout now says Chabura number 5 to number 7. And I don't want to be so audacious as to say that we're definitely going to finish this handout today, because it doesn't matter. Whenever we finish it, we finish it. But you know, we'll have a nice discussion in the meantime. I gave out a lot. So there should be more available. Okay. So we were going through the questions presented. We did a summary of the understanding of Dina de Malchus Adina, and we also discussed some of the parameters of where Bezdin jurisdiction ends and the civil court jurisdiction begins, even from the standpoint of what's legitimate in the eyes of the halakha. So now we're really focusing on the applications of these principles, and we'll see how the sources, how the makoros, support or don't support, as the case may be, these different applications and situations that are discussed in the questions. The first question had to deal with bankruptcy declaration and bankruptcy ramifications, and I think we went through that pretty thoroughly. So now let's move on to the second question. Can Reuven threaten to take Shimon to civil court? Reuven has a grievance. Let's assume a legitimate grievance against Shimon. Maybe it's an unpaid loan, maybe it's a failure to honor a contract, maybe it's failure of a tenant to pay rent. So can Reuven threaten to take Shimon to civil court in order to gain leverage? In other words, Reuven plans to do the right thing according to halacha. If there needs to be a litigation, yes, he will litigate in a Beis Din as opposed to civil court. But he wants to settle outside of court and to shake up Shimon a little bit. So, you know, if you say to somebody, "I'll see you in court," or you send a lawyer letter, so that sometimes shakes up a person a little bit so that they comply with whatever their obligation is, or they reach a settlement with you. So can Reuven just send a threatening letter? He has a lawyer, and the lawyer's a letterhead. You know, he finds some relative who's a lawyer to write a letter on their letterhead, you know, to this person saying, "If you don't comply, then you're going to be in a lot of trouble and we'll see you in court." So can he do that so that he pressures Shimon into settling the case out of court?
We had an earlier shiur that it's only when it's actualized. Remember we talked about, you know, in a contract, you know, up front you can say whatever you want, but you can't actually do it.
Talking about stipulating that your disputes will be settled in court when the other person says that they're not going to go to Beis Din. That's a little bit different. Here, Shimon never said to Reuven that I'm not prepared to go to Beis Din. So here it's more of a threat than a stipulation up front.
You don't intend to do
it. Remember, a threat is more along the lines of those showed me from the Gezeiros of the Takanos of Rabbeinu Tam, right? That if you forcibly take somebody to civil court against their will, so that could even be in the domain of Mesira, giving a person over to the authorities when it's not through mutual consent. Mutual consent, we said, is also prohibited, but maybe not in a contractual setting if it hasn't been actualized, as you pointed out.
Can I threaten to punch somebody in the nose if they don't settle with me? I mean, threaten to punch
is different than punch. Russia, lama tat kereyecha, right?
But that's sake.
That's
just the threat. But the threat
of it. You meirim yad neged chavero.
That's a meirim yad. But can I threaten the meirim yad?
I get an injunction against you if you threaten me.
So Rabbi Yoshua Weiss discusses this question. If you look at source Aleph, let's look at the way in which the prohibition of taking somebody to Arkos is framed. So the way that the Shulchan Aruch frames the prohibition is in a twofold process. It says, "Asur ladun mifnei dayanei avdei kochavim." You're not allowed to adjudicate a case in front of the judges of the secular courts. Uve arko shalehem, or in the courts themselves. So the question is posed by both Rav Asher Weiss and also Ben Zion Vosner, who's a dayan in Muncie, is why not just say "Asur ladun mifnei dayanei avdei kochavim"? Or asuladun mitnei akal shalahem. You can't adjudicate in front of the dayanim. You can't adjudicate in front of the courts. Why does it say? Why is there this double or two part phrase that is recorded in the Shulchan Aruch You can't adjudicate. Or go to the courts. Well, if you're going to the courts, obviously you're adjudicating in front of the judges of the court. So Ravasha Weiss suggests that maybe this means that not only is it a prohibition if you're appearing before the judges and you've gotten to the point of litigation, but if you take any sort of action whatsoever which brings the court into your dispute, or which involves the court in your dispute, where they become a player, so that already is included in the prohibition. So Rav Asher Weiss on that basis argues that even threatening somebody that you're going to take them to secular court if they don't comply with their obligations would be a violation of the way in which the halacha is stipulated in Shulchan Aruch. What did you want to say?
I was just thinking maybe it's making a reference to the possibility of using secular judges as a block.
Well, again, if you're using, it depends the way that you phrase it. So this is why you really could threaten somebody, but if you do it in a way in which you're not specifically invoking the secular court process, maybe you haven't run afoul of this particular prohibition. Let's think about it that way. But why should this be usur? Remember, we spoke at the very beginning about how there are two different theories behind the isur arkos, as to why it's prohibited to go to arkos altogether. One theory was yomiyakir shema libin, that you're giving glorification to a foreign legal system, and the other is that you're meirim yad keneged Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, that you're lifting up your arm against the Torah and the legal system that was given down by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, by Hashem, to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai. So which one of those two different considerations would be implicated in this type of situation, do you think? Or maybe both.
No, I have to disagree, because I just read a book on Beit Din cases, and the Beit Din did care about New Jersey law, what is commercial practice.
Sometimes we care deeply about it. We've discussed that in previous year, that sometimes the secular law gets incorporated into halacha, and that's when that happens, it's not considered to be that you're glorifying the secular legal system per se. You're just incorporating those components of minhag ha'sochrim, or dina d'malchus hadina, as the case may be, into the halachic system. But here, you're talking about just going outside of the halachic system altogether and having the case litigated in civil court as opposed to being litigated in the Beis Din altogether.
But maybe it's with Pershus HaBeis Din. Yeah. Maybe it's with as a shliach. In other words, I'll sue you in court implicitly, halachically, with permission of Bezdin.
Well, if you said so in your letter that I'm going to do this with the Rishus of Bezdin, that's one thing. But if you didn't say that, you just said I'm going to sue you in court, so then there's no implicit Rishus Bezdin. I don't know. It would seem to me that the big problem would be miyakir shem alilim, that you're not maybe miyad nekenegin Torah Moshe Rabbeinu. You haven't yet utilized the secular legal system in order to take anything away from the other person, in order to have a verdict issued against the other individual. What you have done is that you've given them the glorification or the respect, the deference to say this is where I plan to turn and where I think I should turn as far as the person that you're threatening is concerned, this is the place where I would seek relief. So I think that the reason why it's considered to be problematic, the reason why we have this double phraseology in the Shulchan Aruch that would indicate that even this case would be a problem, is because even at the point that you are utilizing the court system in order to strong arm the other person, so you're giving deference, you're giving respect, you're giving glory to that legal system. But as you properly pointed out, there probably are good ways that you could do this, meaning that when you send that letter, you don't have to threaten somebody that you're going to take them to civil court. You could just send a threatening letter to somebody, or threatening might be too strong a word. You could just send a warning letter to somebody saying, you know, you haven't paid your debt to me, or you haven't paid the wages that are due to me for such and such time. If I don't receive payment by a certain day, then I'm going to have to take further action against you. You would say, I'm going to have to take further action against you. You're not necessarily, even if that letter is written by a lawyer, it's perfectly possible, maybe this is what you were getting at, Amiel, that it's perfectly possible that the action that you're going to take is to take the person to a Beis Din. Meaning, as you said, why shouldn't you give the person the benefit of the doubt? So the only time that it really becomes problematic is when you spell out Racha Bitcha Haktana in the letter, saying, if you don't honor your obligations, then I will sue you in the state court, you know, of Cook County, Illinois, and take civil legal action against you. If you're just saying, I'm going to take appropriate action, I think that would be okay. What I'm a little bit less sure about is, let's say the letter is a little bit more explicit, but not completely explicit. Instead of saying that I will take all necessary steps, you know, that need to be taken, I will take all necessary action, you say I will take all necessary legal action against you. So here's the question. If you wrote in a letter and it's signed by law, I'll take all necessary legal action against you, that could even be interpreted as, you know, you're going to utilize your legal recourse, according to Jewish law, which is also a legal system, to take the person to Beis Din. So it could be that as long as, and remember the tshuva of the Rosh that we discussed almost at the very beginning, that if language lends itself to be interpreted in a manner which is consistent with halacha, that's the way that we would interpret it. The Smap talks about a situation where the language is completely unambiguous, that the person only wants to go to civil court, and is that enforceable or is that not enforceable? And most poskim, of course, hold that it's not enforceable. But in the case where the language is ambiguous, everyone agrees that it should be interpreted in the best possible fashion. That's also a general legal principle. You want to interpret things in the best possible fashion so that it would be legal. So therefore, you could say that halakhically as well, you have two Orthodox Jews who have a dispute with each other. One of them sends a letter to the other, even if it's on legal stationery, saying that I'm going to have to take legal action against you if you don't comply with your obligations by a certain date. That could still presumably, I'm just throwing it out there, I said I'm not 100% sure about this, maybe it depends on the people, and it depends on the context, it depends upon what would be the reasonable assumptions of what their understanding would be from the language, but it would seem that under those circumstances, maybe that type of language could also be justified, as long as the individual sending the letter doesn't spell out explicitly that I'm planning to take you to secular court. If they say they're planning to take them to secular court, so according to Rav Asher Weiss, that would be a problem. Yes.
Would we differentiate between the phrase "I will take legal recourse" versus "I will avail myself to all legal recourses"?
That's very good. We say "I will avail myself of all legal remedies."
That sounds like legal secular court.
Or maybe it's better. I thought you were going to make the argument that maybe it's better. You know, I will avail myself of the range and scope of all legal remedies. The range and scope of what doesn't mean you're going to do every single thing according to what's available legally. That would be way too expensive. So I'll avail myself of, you know, the range and the scope of all of the potential legal remedies which are out there, which obviously would include the possibility of arbitration. Now, in the event that that there was already a signed agreement between them, that in the event that they have a dispute, they'll take it in front of a Beis Din, then it's more obvious in that case that if the letter says, I'll take all necessary legal action or something like that, that there would be a clearer implication that it would be legal action consistent with the remedies that already exist between them. And if it's already been spelled out that remedy is going to Beis Din, then that, I think, would be an easier case to justify. Yes?
Since we have an obligation to be done lekaf zchut, why wouldn't we assume that the language, if it's ambiguous at all, refers to Beis Din?
Well, that's what we're saying. That if it's ambiguous at all, then you presumably could rely upon the Rosh. So that's what we're suggesting. We're just trying to figure out the best way to do it, or what language, you know, from the perspective of the person who sends the letter, maybe it's ambiguous, but if anyone else who reads it would think that it's unambiguous, that it means going to court, so maybe that's not so good. So that might depend upon the circumstances, the parties, and the situation. But the mere fact that it's sent by a lawyer, I don't think necessarily imparts the implication that the intention is only going to go to secular court, because lawyers represent parties in front of Beis Din all the time. So I think that getting a lawyer to write such a letter would be perfectly fine. I mean, this is why is it a problem altogether, according to halacha, as we said, because the person is miyakir shem alilim. But also, we have a principle in halacha that you can't, that whenever you threaten somebody, based on an action which would be illegal according to Jewish law, so that's considered to be duress. That's considered to be an onus, And if a person then acts and settles on the basis of such a threat, it might not be enforceable altogether as a matter of halacha. Where do we have an analogous type of situation when it comes to gittin? We spoke a little bit about Jewish divorce, how a get has to be given by a husband of his own free will. So let's say the husband only gives the get because he was threatened that we're going to break his legs, going to break his knees in the event that he refuses to give a get. I was once accused of that. Mm-hmm. One person who filed a lawsuit against me that, you know, when I was serving as director of the Beis Din of America, person said, I was threatened by Rabbi Reese. He left a voice message that he was going to break my knees if I didn't give a get. So I was sued for $5 million. I was flattered that anybody, you know, would think that I could be that tough, but I never did such a thing. I never left such a voicemail message. I never said anything like that to anyone. So, you know, it would have been very interesting to see how he would have gone about trying to prove such a thing that never happened, but, you know, the case never went that far. But those are one of the perils of, you know, working in Beis Din, that, you know, these things sometimes happen. But let's say that a husband was indeed threatened in that fashion, and he only gave a get on the basis of such a threat. So we would say that the get is invalid because it was coerced, because it was threatened. But if you threaten something which is legal, and the threat relates to something that is not the get itself, but the person did some other thing that was completely illegal, and then you threaten that you're going to take the person to Beis Din to enforce your obligations, to enforce your rights. The person, let's say, owes you money. You say, I'm going to enforce my rights against you in Beis Din. And then the person says, in that event, if I give a get, will you promise to, you know, not pursue that course of action? And you say, well, if you give a get to your wife, I won't pursue that course of action. That's called onis ayidei davar acher. That's considered to be duress through something not directly related to the get, and it's considered to be legitimate. But it's only legitimate if what you're threatening is something that you legitimately have the right to do. But if you're going to threaten somebody that you're going to, for example, take them to court when you don't have the right to take them to court, so that would be problematic. So this comes up all the time, that we have situations where guna cases are resolved because of onus ayidei davar acher, with its duress, but it's through an extraneous thing that's not related to the get, where the poskim say that if a get is delivered under those circumstances, then that would be permissible. But it has to be a type of action that would be permissible according to Jewish law. For example, it would be that a criminal type of charge. So if you assume that a person can be turned over for criminal activities nowadays, because we have a just governmental system, and as long as the person really committed the crime, they really could be turned over to the criminal authorities, and it wouldn't be considered to be mesira if you assume that, and the person really committed a criminal action, like they were a drug dealer, and then they're threatened, they say, that will turn you over to the criminal authorities for drugs, and the person says, I'll give a get to my wife, if you don't do that. So then that would be considered to be a valid get under those circumstances. What?
When you have to turn them over to the authorities in such a situation anyway?
What do you mean, would you have to? Not necessarily. I mean, generally speaking, you don't have to hand people over to the authorities. I mean, it depends if they're a threat to society, if they're a menace to society. So maybe drug dealer is not, say they're a marijuana drug dealer, So depending on your perspective, it's the sort of thing where, let's say we determine that it wasn't a threat to society. Okay?
Shouldn't this be us because I'm threatening to do something I have no intention of doing? Huh? Shouldn't it be us because I'm threatening to do something I have no intention of doing? I'm deceiving you.
Gnev us to us.
Yes.
Well, here we're assuming that you're not necessary. Who says that you're not intending to do it?
Oh,
you mean in the case of where the person's threatening the person to go to civil court?
The guy who offered to break your knees wasn't worried about...
the case that you gave earlier, the guy is intends to do the right thing, but he's threatening to do the wrong thing.
So that's another consideration, that you shouldn't engage in Gnevas Das either. That's another good consideration. It's another reason why it would be problematic. I agree with you.
Within theory, an organized court system of America, how much easier is it for Beis Din today? Does it make their job of enforcing, say, a financial settlement easier with an organized, as opposed to like a CAD, a country, or something like that?
Well, I think so. I mean, at least in this country, there is a very strong legal mechanism for the enforcement of Beis Din decisions, because there's a long tradition going back really to the founding of this country to enable people to opt out from using the regular court system and to resolve their disputes through their own community-created arbitration tribunals.
Has it always been accepted as a Beis Din, like in America? How long, you know, how many years back does
it? It really goes back as far as I can tell. Meaning that the notion that of arbitration in America, this the mechanism of being able to just submit your disputes in front of people you're comfortable with, even if they're not the court judges, and to have their decision be binding upon the parties who voluntarily submit in front of them, is a very long-standing American tradition. And it's one that's very, very strongly respected by the entire court system. And there have been a number of Supreme Court decisions which have also validated and reinforced this right and this arbitration system in America. And there are a number of decisions that specifically speak about the ability and the right of Batei Din, of religious arbitration tribunals, to hand down enforceable decisions so long as the parties voluntarily submit to the Beis Din. But the courts have also ruled that even if a Beis Din threatens to issue a seiruv, a contempt order against somebody for refusing to submit to the Beis Din, and only on that basis does the person voluntarily submit to the Beis Din, that's also considered to be a sufficiently voluntary submission to the Beis Din, and the decision of the Beis Din would be equally as binding in those cases, because the Beis Din is not putting a gun to anybody's head. It's just saying, if you want to remain in good standing in the religious community, then you have to submit to the Beis Din, and it's up to anybody voluntarily to decide whether they want to remain in good standing in that religious community, or if they wish, they have the right to leave the community
except
and go elsewhere.
Except for bankruptcy, where that's a different story.
That's correct, which we spoke at length about.
Now, are there other court systems, like within other religions or groups?
There are, especially in the Islamic community. They have the Sharia system, where they have their own religious arbitration courts, which is governed by Sharia law. And there as well, the parties are only governed by the Sharia courts according to American law if they voluntarily submit to the Sharia tribunals. There was a lot of concern that people had in the last decade or so that the Muslims and Islamic law is, you know, eventually going to take over the entire universe. And therefore, there's a lot of, you know, fear of Islamic influences. You've seen that to some degree in Europe. In Canada, there were even certain laws that were passed that courts are not allowed to integrate Islamic law into their decisions. And they even prohibited arbitration courts from functioning, even when the parties themselves would submit to the voluntary adjudication of the arbitration courts, if the arbitration courts could be governed by Islamic law, because they're so fearful of the effects of Islamic law taking over society, and they don't even want people voluntarily within society. Let's say you have Muslim citizens who would voluntarily submit to the Islamic courts. They said, we don't want that in our society, even though everybody's volunteered to it, but we consider Islamic law to be so anathema to our belief system and our ideology that we just don't want that to govern anybody, even if they decide voluntarily that they're going to be bound by it. And as a result, what suffered in the process? Jewish law arbitration suffered in the process. So now, at least in Canada, it's almost impossible to have disputes submitted to rabbinic religious arbitration courts that stipulate that with respect to commercial matters or matters which are outside of the religious realm, that they will be decided according to Jewish law, because once Islamic law is no longer allowed as a matter of arbitration, so the ability to arbitrate cases according to Jewish law has been very significantly curtailed in Canada, and there's a real concern that similar things might happen in America. So there were various statutes that I think were passed in certain states, or at least were submitted for legislative approval in certain states, that say that courts, leaving aside arbitration tribunals, that a judge in a court, if they want to invoke different legal systems in coming to the conclusion in their case, they want to say, well, American law says this, and statute says that. And not only that, but I also am, to some degree, guided or inspired by other legal systems in coming to my decision, and the judge would, in a case, would want to invoke Islamic law, for example. So there were certain statutes that were passed that said, at least in certain states, that a judge should not be allowed to do that because that the legislators were so fearful of the intrusion of Islamic law into their society. So a number of Jewish legal scholars protested against these laws, recognizing that this is a very slippery slope, that once you have such laws on the books, it's only a matter of time before the same will be extended to any kind of religious legal system, to say that a Jewish law cannot be invoked either in arriving at a decision. And it's a very, very thin line between having that type of a statute and going further and saying that not only can courts not invoke these legal systems in justifying the final decision that they've arrived at, but they also are prohibited from, but arbitration tribunals also will be prohibited from deciding cases according to religious law, whether it be Sharia law, whether it be Jewish law.
Does it specifically say Sharia law or Jewish
law? It does specifically, all of these statutes specifically target Sharia law. Interestingly enough.
Couldn't I then say, I'm going to have something that's like Sharia law, but take a few things out, so therefore it's not, assuming the law is even constitutional.
It's a slippery slope. It's a very slippery slope. And the reality is that according to our own interests, of being able to safeguard a religious arbitration system, I think that it's very much in our interest that not to have these statutes passed and to oppose statutes of this sort. The truth of the matter is, and I feel strongly about this, if two members of the Muslim faith want to submit their commercial disputes to an Islamic arbitration court and have it decided according to Sharia law, then that should be 100% permissible, the same way that we feel it should be permissible for Jewish parties. And the only requirements that are built into the system are various procedural safeguards, that the party should have the right to be represented by attorneys, that the decision can't be something that would shock the conscience. We also can't hand down a decision that would shock the conscience.
Like lashes, for example,
or decapitating somebody, or using something. I mean, what are people afraid of? The truth of the matter is that those who are engaged in the Sharia courts are generally doing it. I've met with some of these people. They're very sensible, very responsible people. They really do have a very extensive legal system and legal doctrine in place with respect to all kinds of financial matters, and as long as the arbitration procedural safeguards are being followed, then there's no reason not to respect this type of an arbitration. It does not threaten society in any way. Society is much more threatened when parties are not allowed to adjudicate their disputes in the manner that they, in which they are comfortable, as long as, once again, the procedural safeguards are properly followed. Okay, so that's just a footnote.
So where does the secular body of alternative dispute resolution fit into this conversation?
So this is really all about that secular body. I mean, the secular system of law really encourages very strongly alternative dispute resolution because the courts are clogged anyway, and they need a lot of relief, and they're happy to have the relief of arbitration tribunals where people can go and can decrease the workload and the docket that the courts are saddled with in order to bring about a harmonious resolution of disputes. Generally speaking, is more efficient, it's more economical, and the parties end up being happier as well because they feel like they're more in control of the process when they submit their disputes to communally created dispute resolution forums that their community has actually created for people just like them. And therefore, there is a very, very strong endorsement on the part of the court system of alternative dispute resolution. But alternative dispute resolution doesn't only include religious tribunals for different communities. It also includes arbitration tribunals for different professions, like an arbitration court that resolves disputes between architects, or the arbitration tribunal that's set up by members of the securities industry to resolve securities disputes. Many different industries and professions have their own internal arbitration mechanisms that they utilize. utilized to resolve their disputes. One important issue that came in front of the Supreme Court is what if you have a major conglomerate, you know, a major corporate conglomerate organization that has all of its employees sign, when they enter into their employment contracts, they sign a contract that says that in the event that we ever have a dispute within our employment, within our employer, then we agree that instead of bringing that dispute to court, we're going to bring that dispute to an arbitration mechanism which is set up by the employer, where the employer itself has certain individuals who are assigned, who are in the employ of this company, of this, you know, major mega company, that are assigned to be arbitrators of the dispute. So one of the questions that arose is, does that create an internal inherent, you know, conflict of interest? And the Supreme Court, there's a famous case called Mitsubishi, dealt with this particular issue. So while on the one hand, the court very strongly favors arbitration mechanisms, on the other hand, there also has to be procedural conscionability in the way in which the parties are brought into the agreement to submit their potential future disputes to a particular arbitration mechanism as well. But as long as there has been a procedural due process and there is not a lack of conscionability in the way in which the parties submit to the arbitration in the first place, then it's something which is very much favored, both in a religious arbitration context and a commercial arbitration context. That's why you have the American Arbitration Association that people utilize for the resolution of lots of disputes, including major multimillion-dollar disputes. And it also includes not only arbitration, but it includes what's called mediation. What's the difference between arbitration and mediation? Arbitration is like litigation, where the case is presented in front of a judge or judges to issue a binding decision. Mediation, but it's just that you choose the judges. That's why it's called arbitration. But mediation means where the parties sit around the table and they try to reach a resolution on their own. And if they don't reach a resolution on their own, so then they go back to square one. They have to start the process from the very beginning. But mediation also is facilitated through a mediator, and that's also alternative.
Do you see any distinguishable difference between alternative dispute resolution versus going to court?
Yes, and we discussed that, I think, briefly, but halakhically speaking, there's a statement by Rabbi Akiva Eiger at the very beginning of Chosha Mishma, which Rabbi Akiva Eiger says that if in a particular industry everybody agrees that just going to appear in front of a number of arbitrators who are well versed in that industry, who are going to decide the dispute in accordance with the minhag hasochim, with the custom of the marketplace, and it's not a court proceeding, it doesn't take place in front of a court, and the standard that is utilized by the arbitrators is not secular law, it's just what is the custom of the marketplace. So he says that is completely permissible.
That's not considered to be right.
Whether it's the Jewelers Association or something else, that's not considered to be a violation of halacha. So it's the same type of principle, because that's not a cause. That's not the secular courts.
Going back to this threatening letter, isn't this all the time with corporations on receivables, old receivables threatening to take legal action?
Of course, collection agencies. So this question comes up, for example, where you have yeshivas. And the yeshivas want to be able to collect tuition, and they get tired of just sending letters, of calling up the parents over and over again. So there were certain yeshivas that actually wanted to hire collection agencies. And the question was, is it permissible for yeshiva to hire a collection agency? Well, the collection agency goes after the parents. You haven't yet paid your second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade tuition yet, and we're going to go after you. Or is that problematic if they don't have the right to go after them in civil court? Because the collection agencies are presumably, they're not agents of a Torah organization. They act on their own according to their own protocols and principles, and they presumably are going to threaten bona fide legal action. So is that a problem? So that could potentially be a problem. If there would be a real dispute between the two sides, then for sure there would be a problem if legal action is being threatened by a collection agency, even if the collection agency is working, you know, is working on behalf of a yeshiva or something like that. But ultimately, the collection agency is going to cause the yeshiva to have responsibility for the tactics that are taken. If they're taking them on behalf of the yeshiva or some other Jewish communal or
But that's if there's a real dispute. But it's simply so a collection. Then, we had the Maram.
So then this is, so we discussed, it's very good, we had discussed the Maharsham. So the Maharsham had spoken about what if I have a chob baror? What if I have a type of debt which is unambiguously owed, where there's no real dispute whether the debt is owed? So the Maharsham had argued based on Rabbi Avraham Buchach, the Kesef Kachim, that on such a situation there would not be a violation of Okos, because it's not a litigation, it's just a collection action. If it's only a collection action, there's nothing really to be litigated, the defendant would not really have a claim or any kind of a defense, so in such a case it would be legitimate to go straight to civil court. But it's based on the assumption that, number one, Makok Bezdin Yapet, that the Bezdin itself does not have the power to adjudicate the matter, because the other party would not submit to the Bezdin. Number two, that there is no real type of argument that would have to be presented for a decision maker to decide upon other than the collection of the debt itself. So this is a big question, because when a person has money owing to them, usually it's the case that the plaintiff feels it's a chob baror, that it's an unambiguous, completely impossible to dispute obligation. But from the perspective of the defendant, it's often not an unambiguous obligation. They might actually have some defenses. So what we say to yeshivos is that if you have an action where somebody hasn't paid debt, before you can turn to the secular court to collect the debt, you really should go to the bezdin in the first instance. Because for all you know, maybe the person has a defense. And I've seen this, where the side would say, where the other side says, well, we had an agreement. It wasn't put in writing, but we had an oral agreement that we wouldn't have to pay more than 50% tuition for that year, and we paid that with 50%, and we don't have to pay more. And the yeshiva says, no, we never had such an agreement, or you misunderstood the agreement, or the agreement ran out at a certain point, you didn't understand that the agreement ran out at a certain point. So sometimes there really are substantive disputes, even with respect to things that appear to be unambiguous obligations. So therefore, we are very wary. When we've been asked this question, we do not feel comfortable with any type of Torah institution hiring a collection agency to send threatening letters saying we're going to take you to civil court, because it's not clear that they really have the right to do so. So therefore, the letters would have to say things along the lines of we'll take appropriate legal action or avail ourselves of all appropriate legal remedies. Avail ourselves of all appropriate legal remedies. That's an even better language. Okay, write that one down.
What if instead of hiring somebody, I sell it to somebody else? They're not going to be bound by halacha if they're not a Jewish company.
So I sell it to somebody. It doesn't have to sell it to somebody else, because ultimately the obligation began as an obligation of this person towards you. It's really between two Jewish parties.
If I sold it, it's not between the Jewish parties.
Are you saying that you're selling
at a discount?
You're selling at a discount to a collection agency. I think at the very least it's mechur hadavar, because it's the underlying obligation is essentially an obligation that began between two Jewish parties. But you're going to sell the obligation?
What about the issue?
I don't know if you could you sell such an obligation? I suppose that...
you could sell anything.
Business. Yeah.
What about the issue? You could sell loans and I get my mortgage.
Whoa. That's already in a totally different domain. If we're talking about ribbis obligations there, that's a totally different story, and maybe we'll get to it at some point in time. We're not there yet. But that's an interesting question. I suppose that if you had an obligation that started out as an obligation to a Jew, from a non-Jew, from a Jewish party to another Jewish party, now it's been sold, so it's an obligation of one Jewish party to a non-Jewish party. If the other party really has a complete ownership of it at this point in time, and there's no involvement anymore by the Jewish party who sold it, so that might be a different story. But often in these cases, I think there still is some involvement, because the collection agency might be collecting it, giving it over to the yeshiva, and simply taking a certain cut, by virtue of serving as a collection agency. But if something is completely 100% sold, and the Jewish party no longer has any interest, then you could be correct. Yes. Okay. It's a very good point. It's a very good point.
Within professional boards, what about if somebody has a kind of an attorney, and they go to the bar association fee or to the licensing authority? And that may apply to real estate licenses.
This is a, that's a, you're talking about a different case where somebody has a, some type of a grievance against a Jewish attorney, and that they want to bring that Jewish attorney to the licensing agency in order to file the grievance. But it's not necessarily a court action, or is it a court action? Yes? Well, it depends. If there might be criminal ramifications, it could be a problem with you. It's only a question of not being able to hold on to the license, as opposed to some type of criminal action. If it could be a question of being disbarred, so that does raise certain questions.
So it loses parnasa, that's right. All. That would be a bezdin thing.
Again, if you're going to cause a loss of parnasa, then there could be a grounds for the other party to bring the one who filed the grievance to bezdin. But is it absolutely prohibited to go to the legal to the bar association, to the professional association, in order to file a grievance against somebody if it's not technically a court action, and it's not technically a criminal action? It's neither in civil court nor in criminal court. It's just in the context of the person's association, their professional associations. I'm not sure that that would be prohibited per se according to any of the rules that we're speaking about over here, but it might be just a nasty thing to do. Just from an ethical perspective, we also try to act in a fashion which is nice and ethical.
But if a person goes, let's say, to the ARDC to report because he believes that his attorney, for whatever reason, or this attorney deserves to report it, has not been considered most circle from which I saw?
I'm not sure, meaning if you go to a criminal court and you are going to turn over somebody based on a criminal allegation, so that runs the question of when is it prohibited to do so, when is that a problem? Mesira, we mentioned that according to the Aruch HaShulchan and the Tzitz Eliezer, there's no such problem as Mesira altogether nowadays, and not everybody agrees with that.
We're not talking criminal. I mean,
right.
He doesn't like his attorney for whatever reason.
Right, but to gratuitously cause somebody a loss when there is no benefit that the person who's handing the person over, the one who's filing the grievance is going to receive this action, then that is considered to be a separate problem of hashavas aveda, that you're going to give over somebody to the authorities, because whom presumably if they could find the offense on their own, then they would have disciplined the person on their own, but you're making it easier for them. So you're not supposed to make it easier for them unless it's either to prevent a chilul Hashem or to create a kiddush Hashem, or you have some skin in the game because this person is otherwise causing harm to you, and what you're doing is not gratuitously handing the person over, but you're pursuing a course of action that you need to pursue for your own claim. So if it doesn't fall into any of those categories where you need to do it in order to recover your own losses, or where it's something where you've been asked by the government to serve in this capacity, so that it would be a chil Hashem if you defied, a specific request of a governmental agency, or you're just gratuitously doing it because you dislike somebody and the person's not even necessary. Let's say the person was causing harm to the community, that makes it a harabim. So that's a case where the Shulchan Aruch says that it would be appropriate to turn somebody in. But if it doesn't satisfy any of those criteria, then it's not considered to be a nice thing to do. Pashtus, if that's all you're talking about, you're doing it as a matter of revenge, so then it would seem like it's not something that we would endorse halakhically.
Yeah. Maybe the Shulchan Aruch is telling you, even if you have Dayanei Yisrael,
That's a little bit of a stretch, because certainly at the time Shulchan Aruch was written, there wasn't an expectation that Jewish members of the community would be serving as judges in their own cause. So I don't think that was would be the intention of the Shulchan Aruch. Might that be true? Independently, the Chazon Ish would say, yeah, that's very true. Rabbi Yosef would say it's even worse in Israel, where there shouldn't be any arkos. There's no justification for arkos. Everything should be run by Batei Din. So it's even worse to serve as a judge over there. But it might not necessarily be a problem to serve as a judge in a legitimate civil court system if you're Jewish. In America or in any place where there is a legitimate system of arkos, particularly if you're going to adjudicate cases where the parties have every legitimate right to be in front of a court. You have two non-Jewish parties. You have a Jewish party against a non-Jewish party that are in civil court.
About being so it's perfectly okay for someone from to be even a legitimate dayan to be a judge in a secular court.
Absolutely. Look, my grandmother wanted me to become a Supreme Court justice when I grew up, you know.
But as far as bringing a dispute before a secular court, even where the judge is dayan,
no, it would still be a prohibition of arkos, unless the judge was able to turn the entire civil court into a bezdin for a day.
That's what I'm saying. So maybe you can see that.
No, because that no, I don't think so. I don't think so. That would be such a far-fetched type of case, such a milsad lo shchicha, that if the Shulchan Aruch was going to bring a case that was a milsad lo shchicha, would spell it out more specifically. Otherwise, you have to understand the words according to their simple meaning. So this really leads us to this next question, because the next question is exactly what we're discussing now. Yeshiva has a huge bill of unpaid tuition that wishes to collect from a delinquent family. Since it is only a case of bill collection, can they go straight to the civil courts to collect the payment without stopping by Beit Din? And as we said, it would depend. If you hold like the Maharsham, whenever I have a whole borrower, I have an unambiguous debt, then presumably there is some sort of a dispensation. On the other hand, when the person might actually have certain defenses, then you can't just automatically take the person to a civil court. And this gets us to some of the comments that were made by the Shevet Alevi, not in this handout, but in a previous handout, where the Shevet Alevi of Shmuel Vosner pointed out that if there are, let's say that the defendant has some type of a defense, either a counterclaim or some defense as to why they feel that they don't owe the money, so then you don't know whether they have such a defense, so you should really take them to Beis Din first. Let's say it's just a question of enforcing the Beis Din decision. So we had already said that when it comes to enforcing the Beis Din decision, then for sure we would allow somebody to go to secular court, because that's considered to be serving as an arm of the Beis Din when the secular court is just enforcing the Beis Din decision. But let's say that the defendant in the case, who lost the case in Beis Din, feels the Beis Din made a mistake, and they're going to appeal the decision of the Beis Din. They feel the Beis Din made a mathematical miscalculation. The Beis Din missed a very important point. So here, Rav Vosner as well says that it's not necessarily so simple that we would allow somebody even to enforce a Beis Din decision in court if the other party has a legitimate reason to contest the Beis Din ruling. And he says that if there is reason to contest the Beis Din ruling, then the Beis Din should hear the grievance first as to why the person is contesting the ruling, because otherwise what's going to happen? The person will appeal the ruling in court. So isn't it better to appeal the ruling in Beis Din than to appeal the ruling in court? So this is why a number of Batei Din, both in Eretz Yisrael and here in America as well, a number of Batei Din, including the Chicago Rabbinical Council Beis Din, including the Beit Din of America in New York, have built into their procedures and protocols and the rules and procedures of the Beis Din an appellate process where they, in the event that one side feels that the Beis Din made a mistake, rather than bringing their appeal to civil court, they should be able to bring their appeal to Beis Din. But this
same
way, the
Beis Din
process remains within the Beis Din. Not the same group of people, because it's sort of difficult for the same Dayanim to question themselves. But although if it's just a question of a mathematical miscalculation, that is presumably something that they can do. It depends on what it is. But it gets brought up to the next level. It gets brought up to, let's say, the Av Beis Din didn't sit on the case. The case was presided over by other Dayanim, and the appeal is brought to the Av Beis Din. So here there's a difference between the Beis Din of America and the Beis Din of Chicago Rabbinical Council for the very reason that you suggested. In the Beis Din of America, there's something like 15 different rotating Dayanim. The Av Beis Din doesn't generally sit on most cases. So therefore, it's very easy to have a mechanism that says that not only if there's a question of a mathematical miscalculation or a mistake with respect to the description of real property, gave the wrong address or something like that, or you wrote down the wrong name of the person who's liable, but if there's a real mistake in Jewish law, they're alleging that there was a mistake in Jewish law, you can't have the same dayan and make that determination, so you turn that over to the abezdin, and the abezdin makes that determination. In fact, there was a case like that. A number of years ago, there was a divorce dispute in which it revolved around the prenuptial agreement, and the wife had sued the husband in the bezdin that she wanted to get, and they had been separated for 6 months. And the husband, after the six, as soon as he received notice, he didn't know that she wanted to get per se, but you know, because they, you know, sometimes a couple is separated and maybe they'll reconcile, maybe they'll take their time before they get around to the divorce. But she sued him in the bezdin for a get, and as soon as she asked for the get, he immediately gave her a get. And she said, "Well, according to our prenuptial agreement, it says that as soon as we're separated and we're no longer living as husband and wife, you're obligated to give me $150 a day. So I also want the $150 a day for the past 6 months." We've since changed the language in the prenuptial agreement to have it say that, that the wife is entitled to $150 a day from the moment in time when she notifies the husband that she plans to start collecting the $150 a day. But this is before that language change was made in the prenuptial agreement. And the Besdin ruled that even though the husband gave the get in a timely fashion, which is one of the goals of having the prenuptial agreement, and he never held the get up, he never used it as leverage or weapon or bargaining chip against her, but nonetheless, since according to the strict language of the prenuptial agreement, she was entitled to this support amount for as long as they were separated, he would have to, you know, pay that amount of money for at least from when she initiated the case. So, I'm sorry? In any event, the husband appealed the case. And he appealed the case, not in secular court, but he appealed the decision in Besdin. And it went to the Abezdin. In this particular case, the Abezdin delegated, as he sometimes does, he delegated the appeal to the Sgan Abezdin, to the assistant Abezdin. It was Rabbi Mordechai Willig. In this particular case, and Rabbi Willig went over all of the evidence, and he came to the conclusion that the decision was mistaken. That there's such a thing in halacha as a waiver, that if a woman is entitled even for mizonah, she's entitled to receive sustenance from her husband when they're separated, she doesn't ask for it, so there's an assumption that there's waiver until such time that she's actually asked for it. So he ruled that the decision was an error and therefore struck the monetary payment. So then the wife appealed the appellate decision, and she went to the court. I think that the parties lived in Maryland at the time. This is a case of Maryland, and it's called Lane versus Levy or something like that. You can look it up. It's a published decision. And the Court of Appeals said, well, since the Besdin itself had and built in appeal process, and this was the process that was utilized by the parties, therefore the court, the civil court, will respect that appellate process that was built in to the arbitration. And since in the appellate process the original decision was overturned, that is the decision that will be maintained and upheld by the court. So this is, from a halakhic standpoint, the ideal way to ensure that every single aspect of the litigation, both the initial proceeding and also in the event that there would be any type of an appeal that a person could legitimately bring to the initial decision, that would also go through the Besdin process. It ensures that there be a proper Besdin process from the very beginning to the very end. And it is also something which, as we have seen, is a framework that will be respected by the secular courts as well.
And not CRC, you're saying?
Now, why is it now? CRC is more limited for the following reason. In CRC, it's very difficult to always ensure that you're going to have an Av Besdin who was involved in the initial case, because we just don't have so many Dayan. The good thing about the CRC, there are many good things about the CRC. One of the many wonderful things about the CRC is that we have regular standing dayanim. And it's not just a question of we have a rotating door, different dayanim, which also has its advantages, but all of our dayanim are really there on a very regular basis, either full-time or part-time, but we have regular dayanim, regular sitting dayanim. What that means is that you generally get the same dayanim in every single case. You'll have the same four dayanim, really, who sit in the CRC, and there's a rotation, and now one of Rabbi Schwartz should have a Rav Shlema, but now you really have, you know, the same three dayanim who sit on pretty much every single case at this point in time. And what that means is that it'd be much more difficult to build in a process where if there was an allegation that there was a real mistake made in the reasoning of the decision, that this is something that would be brought to a dayan who did not originally sit on the case. So therefore, we allow for an appeal process, but our appeal process is more limited in nature, meaning that the parties can come back to the Beis Din if they feel that there was a mistake made, it was a type of mistake, which would be something that legitimately and reasonably could be brought back to the original panel. Meaning where the where it's a question of, you said that I owe $1,000 because I owe $400 for this and I owe $500 for that, and you said, oh, $400 plus $500, $1,000. And you know what? I don't think it really adds up to $1,000. Can you please check your math again? So that's something which even the original panel would be able to do. Or you said that the property that was in dispute was located on Morris, and really it was located on Estes. And, you know, that's something where you can trust the original panel to correct, you know, those types of mistakes and make those types of clarifications. But if it's substantive, so we don't feel comfortable saying that a substantive type of question should go back to the original panel, unless both parties say that they feel comfortable bringing a substantive, you know, objection to the psak, to the original panel, which sometimes happens, but that's not something that we automatically build in to our rules and procedures, because that's something that works better when you have an abez then who generally has not sat on the original case.
And you wouldn't build in to go to the RCA Bezin or something as an appeal?
No, I think that's a little bit too complex, because I think that at least in America, when people go to one Beis Din, they see that as the entity that they're comfortable with. We don't really have a hierarchy of Batei Din in America at this point in time. We have a number of different Batei Din. They'd all respect each other and have cooperative relations with each other, but not in the sense of a hierarchy. Per se. The Gemara Sanhedrin does talk about the notion of going to the Beis Din Hagadol, for one party saying that I would like. Right. But even if there's a shot of some sort, or where there's a question as to whether this Beis Din really thought through the Tainos fully. So there is some sort of a mechanism that is discussed in the Gemara. It wouldn't be entirely fair or accurate to say that Halakha does not have an appellate system. There is some sort of an appellate system built in. And that was really the basis for the justification for having an appellate system in the Beis Din structure in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Avadya Yosef has an extensive tshuva about this as well, where he shows that there really is a basis even from the Gemaras in the Shulchan Aruch as well. There's some sort of a basis for an appellate system.
$150 a day. Wasn't that written by Rav Avadya?
the agreement, which is why it was which is why he was so qualified to sit as a dayan in this case, because he understood how this amount was meant to be applied. This reasoning process that he had about the amount and how it's supposed to be paid and applied, he published it afterwards in a separate essay in one of the Beis Din of America journals. But that was just an interesting application of having this type of an arbitration process. So what we would do, I'll just conclude with this, what we would do, and then I'll take your question, what we would do is that if it was a yeshiva in a tuition collection action, what I would say is that in the first instance, it's appropriate to try to take the parents or the family to Beis Din if they need to litigate at all. If they use a collection agency, the collection agency should not threaten to go to a civil court. But in the event that, let's say, they did decide that they're going to just collect these amounts in civil court and bypass the Beis Din, so I don't know that we would necessarily issue a seru. for a refusal to come to Beis Din in such a case, because since there is the opinion of the Maharsham that if you have a chov baror, if you have an unambiguous obligation, and many could reasonably argue that if there is a tuition agreement on the books, and a promissory note on the books, and there isn't any clear, obvious prima facie defense that a party would be able to present, nor are they arguing a clear defense other than simply the argument of why are they taking me to court, let them take me to Beis Din instead. And all that really seems to be saved over here is the enforcement step of, having the amount confirmed by Beis Din before it's actually enforced and collected in civil court. So I don't know that we would necessarily issue a seiruv, issue a contempt order against an institution for refusing to utilize Beis Din in such a case, but I do believe that it's the proper and correct thing to do. Yes.
Sorry, a technical thing with the appeal with the RCA. Did Rabbi Willig, was he together with the convener Beis Din?
No. Because the appellate process is to an individual. So, the way the appellate process works is that there isn't a new litigation. It's just that the appellate dayan looks at all of the facts, looks at the reasoning of the decision, and then determines whether it was, in his opinion, correct according to Jewish law or
but
not.
It's not better to have a Beis Din going against a previous another Beis Din?
No. It's in order to ensure that there be just an appropriate review process, because this way you're doing everything Kedas Kedin and you're checking yourself and you're making sure that you operate with the utmost integrity. Okay, Mietz Hashem, next week we will meet again, and I think we'll continue on these same sheets. I think we'll be here for a little while.
Okay. What?